Okay, good morning and welcome to council for the second council and people in the virtual gallery for the second case on today's oral argument calendar. I apologize for the delay. We've had some technical issues both at the beginning and in between the first and the second cases that we had to take some time to attend to that, but now all three members of the court are fully connected. So I will now call the second case, which is A21-1393 in the matter of the appeal by John Casterton of the order of license revocation of adult foster care license. I believe that both attorneys are familiar with the court's procedures, which are substantially similar on the Zoom format as when we're in the courtroom. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for rebuttal argument. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client or clients, and you may begin your argument.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Hansen, and I represent John Casterton, the relator in this appeal. This case is ultimately about statutory interpretation. The issue before the court is whether the commissioner was obligated, pursuant to Minnesota Statute 245A.07, Subdivision 1A, to consider the nature, chronicity, severity of the violations of law or rule, and the effect of the violation on the health, safety, and rights of persons served by the program, when making a determination that the commissioner was going to revoke Mr. Casterton's license pursuant to 245, I'm sorry, AO, pursuant to 245.03, subdivision 7.
Just to be clear, your argument is only that, correct? You're not arguing that that your client has its primary residence, the North Branch home. Are you? It wasn't clear in your brief whether you were conceding that point and arguing only the these other factors.
Judge Ross, we're not conceding that point. Our belief and contention remains that the Finlayson home was his primary residence and that the evidence supports that conclusion. However, I recognize that the standard review is substantially less favorable to my client on that. And I believe that this court is much more constrained in how it would consider the elements there.
And you agree that the evidence that came in on that subject was pretty consistent, that your client slept at the other home and had a room at the other home and did not sleep at the Finlayson home? Regularly, I mean.
I think there was some disagreement on that, and the record is a little unclear on that. I will concede the point that he did occasionally sleep at the North Branch home in addition to the Finlayson home. Ultimately, there is a question. The statutory scheme that we're working under does not define what residency means. We've cited to other instances in Minnesota law that would, whereby the residency that Mr. Casterton had at the Finlayson residence would meet other definitions of residency.
Do you agree, though, that the statutory adjective of primary would lead us to conclude that the statute refers to one, that there has to be one residence and not multiple? Even if he could say that he had residences in multiple places, the statute is focused on the one that is most significant.
I would agree with that, Judge Ross. I think that there has to be a conclusion that one of those two properties was his quote unquote primary residence. And ultimately, I would contend that the evidence supports that that is the Finlayson residence, and that goes to the things such as his driver's license, such as the utilities. And if you look to the testimony that was offered,
which the fact finder found to be just papers, as a matter of, again, weighing the evidence, which we don't do, and credibility, that those were just papers in an effort to support a ruse. Not the words of the fact finder, but I think that's implied.
I guess I would disagree with that characterization, because I didn't view it as ruse. I viewed the way the fact finder drew the conclusions to say, basically, that to paraphrase some of Mr. Fredrickson's argument, that he had a nomadic lifestyle, and that there wasn't a quote unquote primary residence for Mr. Casterton anywhere. And I think that, because we don't have a statutory definition in this section to conclude that he had no primary residence at Finlayson is error. But again, that's really not what I would like to focus on, because I do believe that the court really doesn't have to get into that, because we have to grapple with the specific language of 245A07.
What about the specific language of 245A.04?
In your question there, if I understand correctly, Judge Smith, are you referring to that it must be revoked? And are
correct.
You asking about 245A.03 subdivision?
No, where it says it must be revoked or shall be revoked.
Okay. I believe that the language that you're asking about is in 03 subdivision 7, where it says, if an adult foster care license is issued during the moratorium and the license holder changes the license holder's primary residence away from the physical location of the foster care license, the commissioner shall revoke the license according to section 245A07. I believe that's the mandatory language that you're referring to, Judge?
Yes.
Okay. I think that throws into, you know, this question into light here, because that language that says shall revoke also says it shall be done pursuant to 245A07. And 245A07 also has identical shall language. When applying sanctions authorized under this section, the commissioner shall consider. And then there's these factors. I would concede the point that it could have been written more clearly. But I do believe that 245A07, which deals with the sanctions that the commissioner can apply to license holders, has to be applied in its entirety. And so when it says shall revoke pursuant to 245A07, then that means that the ALJ has to consider these other factors.
So in light of the fact that no one is allowed to have a license for any residence that is not a primary residence, how would we, I mean, I understand your point about the statutes clearly seem to be awkwardly written because of the reference to A07 after the shall revoke, but reading the whole statute in context, knowing that a license is not even allowed, a person can't even be licensed to begin with. If it is a license to a home that is not a primary residence, considering the statute as a whole, how would we adopt your view? How could we overlay these other considerations to the shall revoke obligation?
Ultimately, I think that the other language in subdivision 1 of 245.07 ultimately controls, because the question is, what are the sanctions that the commissioner can apply? And I believe that if you read the statutory...
Just so we're clear, your argument then would lead to the result that someone could become licensed as a primary, at a primary residence. And then after receiving the license, the next day can move to a different residence so long as the person is still providing care at the residence he's left. Assuming that the care is sufficient, meets all the considerations that that are included in the AO7 statute. Do you agree that would be the import of your argument?
No, I don't, Judge Ross. I believe that the answer would be that there would be, if you read the sanctions section as a whole, that there are other tools available to the commissioner to compel. And if in your scenario, somebody simply was providing the care but said, this is not my primary residence, I believe that the commissioner could properly weigh, the nature, chronicity, severity of the violation and say it has to be your primary residence and you shall live there. And if you continue to fail to do so, then we will terminate.
How is that the license? So? Why would you have that authority if you've weighed everything and it turns out that, as you're arguing in this case, the care, there's no significant impact on the care that's being provided and so forth, and all those consideration factors would weigh against revoking. And why would the commissioner ever have the authority? What is the statutory basis for the commissioner then to have the authority to then later revoke for failure to comply with the directive to make it the primary residence if the statute itself isn't enough to force a primary residence requirement?
I think the statute does, and I guess the point that I'm trying to articulate is that I believe that the statute also provides some flexibility to the ALJ. And specifically, I'd point the court to the early language in subdivision one, where it talks about the commissioner may suspend or revoke the license, impose a fine, or secure an injunction against the continuing operation of the program if he doesn't apply with applicable law. So I believe that, to your point, if there was a conclusion that, for example, Mr. Casterton was not living in his primary residence, that there could be an injunction saying you cannot operate it, and if unless it's your primary residence, and if you fail to establish that it's your primary residence, then we will proceed with revocation. The point being that I believe...
So you're just saying there's a two-step process to revoke, but the authority to revoke still exists?
The authority to revoke still exists, but it is premised on the idea that you are going to weigh these factors and that the sanctions section as a whole contemplates giving the commissioner the authority to compel license holders through a variety of means to abide by the statute, and that in weighing a punishment under the statute, the commissioner is empowered with basically a process whereby they can force compliance with the statute. And I do not believe that that means that there is no choice other than it has to be revoked.
And except for the fact that the cumbersome language, I'm trying to fit your theory into the language. So you shall revoke according to this other statute, but you're saying when you get there and you go through the considerations that you still have this obligation to revoke, but you're saying the obligation to revoke can't be enforced unless there's a preliminary opportunity to cure, I guess, is what you're suggesting. You can suspend. It seems like if that's what the legislature wanted to do, it could have done so in a whole lot less convoluted way.
I would certainly agree with you that this could have been done in a less convoluted way, Judge Ross. I do believe that if you read the statutory scheme as a whole, it contemplates this idea that there are alternatives to revocation. Otherwise, the subdivision 7 would not have said pursuant to 245.07. And that there could have been different language in that revocation, and it could have said 245.07 doesn't apply.
It seems like for your theory to work, it would have to be may revoke according to 07, not shall revoke. And that's the difficulty I'm having with, you know, if you still have the obligation to revoke, but you just have to do it according to a different statute. You don't quite have me. I'll just be honest with you.
Fair. And I believe that the statutory language that you're looking for that authorizes the may revoke is embedded in the whole of 245A07 and in basically Section A, may suspend or revoke the license, impose a fine, or secure an injunction. And I believe that...
But don't you see the difficulty there? You shall revoke under a provision that allows you to revoke in your discretion. You may revoke. That seems... I'm having a logical problem with that.
I believe that there is some inherent inconsistency between the two statutory sections, but I don't believe that you can ignore section, you know, the specific call out to apply 245.07 and then say, but there's no discretion when the statute specifically says you have to weigh these factors. And so I believe that the discretion is embedded in 245A07 subdivision A, and that is where, ultimately, for public policy purposes, this discretion is vested in the commissioner, that we do not want, as a statutory scheme, a revocation, no appeal. We want to consider these other factors, and the commissioner can change, basically, the conclusion of whether or not revocation is inappropriate. And I would follow up on that point to say, I believe that you could consistently have these two work together and have the commissioner say, I'm going to revoke your license unless you demonstrate that this is your primary residence, and basically issue a provisional licensure with an injunction. I see my time's expired. Happy to revisit this.
Before you mute, Mr. Hansen, I have a question about 0.07 sub 1. The first sentence makes reference to a license holder who does not comply with applicable law or rule. And the second sentence makes reference to the violation of law or rule and the effect of the violation. So, I mean, does a license holder violate the law by moving out of his or her initial primary residence, which is the foster home, to a different location?
I would say that yes, that there is an obligation to maintain the adult foster home as the primary residence.
So if a law or rule is violated, where is that law or rule found?
I would say that rule is found at 245.03 subdivision 7.
And the language of that subdivision does not exactly, it doesn't have a language that is phrased in terms of a license holder shall or a license holder shall not, ... I mean, it's what the commissioner shall do. I guess the second sentence says, and the license holder changes his or her primary residence away from the physical location, then such and such. You know, I suppose it recognizes that people are free to live wherever they wish, but if they're a license holder, then there are consequences. But I don't know. I mean, I'm wondering if there's any other statute or rule that imposes an obligation on the license holder, you know, and by its terms or by its language, says what the license holder must do, may not do, and so on.
I'm not aware of other statutory provisions other than the ones that we briefed here that imposes further conditions and That's not to say that they don't exist, Judge Johnson, but we did do some looking in part because this whole question of what is the primary residence is, you know, the language we have here is basically all the guidance we have on what constitutes a primary residence.
Appreciate that. Okay, thank you. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and begin your argument.
Thanks, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Reese Fredrickson. I'm the county attorney in Pine County, and I represent the respondent, Minnesota Department of Human Services. Now, I think we can all agree that the licensing moratorium is clear in section 245A.03 sub 7A. The commissioner cannot issue a license to an AFC for a physical location that's not the primary resident of the license holder for the entire period of the license. And the sanction is clear too if the residency changes. Under that same provision, the commissioner shall revoke the license according to 245A.07. I think it's been mentioned before, it's fairly simple. If the license holder is not the primary resident, he or she cannot have a license. And obviously there's some policy considerations with that. And that when the clients are in these AFCs, they're signing up for 24/7 care. And they're signing up for that higher level care that can be provided by a resident. The argument,
the big picture question about your argument, and taking a step further back, when I read the ALJ's decision, it seems to focus exclusively as a basis for revocation on the failure to live at the North Branch home. But your brief takes a position that the ALJ based the decision on two factors. One, alternatively, one being failure to maintain a primary residence at the North Branch home, and the other regarding this informing the county that Mr. Edholm had moved into the home instead of the appellant. I didn't see anywhere in the ALJ's decision this alternative basis. I know it seems to have been argued before it got to the ALJ, but I read the ALJ's decision. I don't see anything about that as a reason. Am I correct, or do you think I've misread the ALJ's reasoning?
No, Judge Ross, you are correct. It wasn't an alternative basis for the revocation. The revocation is centered on the primary residency question. That's addressed in my brief because the appellant brought it up in his brief, and so I felt I had to address it. But really, I don't know if actually a revocation would even apply if that was by itself as an issue. I think the big issue here is the residency, and this is why this was revoked.
Well, going back to the primary argument, then, can you address this according to 0.07 language? I mean, I assume you agree that it's at least cumbersome, and it's or maybe you have a way to explain it in a linear fashion to show that it's perfectly clear what it means.
And Judge Ross, the way I've read this, so it says revoke it according to 245A.07. Now, that section includes the procedural requirements for revoking a license. And I think that's why it says according to that section, because when you reference 245A.07, if you look at subdivision 3B, there are notice provisions of when a license is revoked. It's got to be in writing. It's got to be served by certified mail or personal service. There's a discussion of notice of appeals and timelines. And then
the legislature does this all the time where they don't just cite to a statute. They'll cite to a subdivision or a paragraph within a subdivision. We don't have that here.
Correct. And I'd agree that it would have made this much more clear if they specifically called out the subdivisions in here. But again, yeah, there's timeline requirements in subdivision 7 and such. Just to going back to address that subdivision 1A, which is the heart of the argument from the appellant regarding the nature, chronicity, and severity of the violation, there is an important qualifier in that sentence. And it says, when applying sanctions authorized under this section, the authority for this sanction for the revocation is actually authorized under 245A.03. It's not authorized under 245A.07. And when you parse through .07, you'll see that there is a list of sanctions that are authorized within that section. Things like not safely providing for child foster care, where the license holder is criminally charged, where there's subsequent violations on an appeal, failing to comply with Chapter 245C, providing false or misleading information in an application, and requirements for non-compliant child care and foster care centers. Obviously, those don't apply in this case. I know Mr. Hansen argued that the 245A.07 has to be applied in its entirety, and most of the provisions in there don't apply when we're talking about this primary residency revocation. So really, it comes down to that language refers only to the for the sanctions authorized under that section. And I'd also point out that there is some authority within that section that recognizes that there are other sections in Minnesota law where revocation is required, and not just within this one, specifically Subdivision 3.5 or Subdivision 3, Paragraph 5 mentions revocations under 245A.04. kind of being outside that section. So that subdivision 1A would not apply. It all comes down to common sense for me. If he's not the primary, this is not his primary residence, he moves out, the only sanction is revocation, then why would there be something different with this statute? And so why would you look at one statute and say, this is mandatory revocation on this side, but let's put that aside and then look at 245A.07 and do something less with that. And in a way, it's giving somebody a benefit for this ruse or deceiving the commissioner and getting a license in the first place and not really living there. And then saying, okay, well, you made it this far. We'll give you some leeway on this, even though you deceived us in the beginning. To read it that way creates this absurdity, and Section 645.17 presumes that the legislature did not intend an absurd or unreasonable result with this. So for those reasons, I would ask that the court affirm the commissioner's decision, and I will end my argument there. Be happy to take further questions.
It appears that there are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Fredrickson. Mr. Hansen, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to start right away with the argument that this is an absurd result, that it says shall revoke under 245A03 subdivision 7, and that applying the rest of 245A07, the review of the nature, chronicity, severity of the offense is somehow an absurd result. And I would suggest the opposite. And I believe that if the court reads the ALJ's decision, you can see exactly why this is not an absurd result if there's something other than a complete revocation. And that point is made throughout the ALJ's decision, that essentially that there's a problematic neighbor who basically daily picked up the phone and filed a complaint. And, you know, the ALJ makes the point repeatedly in the decision that the level of care that's being provided is what we hope to have for adult foster care, and that there are no issues there. And so I believe that the statutory scheme, by specifically tying the, you know, subdivision 7, tying to 245A07, that is the goal of the statutory plan, that there needs to be some sort of release valve built into it that allows discretion on the part of the commissioner.
Can you address Mr. Fredrickson's alternative way to, sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to get to this point, because I thought it might have been a little stronger argument, Mr. Fredrickson, than the one that you're challenging, which is the one way to reconcile the statutes is to look at A07 and the prefatory language when applying sanctions authorized under this section. When the sanctions are authorized instead under AO3, subdivision 7, when it comes to leaving a primary residence. How do you respond to that?
I don't believe that the sanction resides solely in subdivision 7 of 245.03. And that's in the express language, because it says the commissioner shall revoke the license according to section 245.07. The legislature could have cut off that sentence and said the commissioner shall revoke the license.
Right, but there's no procedural discussion in that section, but there is in AO7. Is that correct?
Well, respectfully, Judge, other than the notice provisions, I don't think that there are significant. If the answer is that it's a bright line.
I mean, just to make sure the procedural due process is met. I mean, there has to be some notice and an opportunity to be heard. And that's not in the first subdivision, but in the second one. Correct me if I'm wrong about that.
No, I believe that's true. But the legislature could have said 245A07, you know, subdivisions, you know, 3, 4, 5, you know, the procedural safeguards, and specifically exempted 245A07 subdivision 1, and did not. And I believe that the court has to grapple with that. And I believe that there's a public policy and a statutory basis to say if the statute mandates that the revocation shall follow 245.07, then the shall language of considering the nature, chronicity, and severity also has to apply. That you can't do violence to the statutory scheme and say, well, you know, the court didn't mean for the, or the legislature didn't mean to apply that portion of the shall sanction. I don't believe that holds together logically. And I think it does violence to what the purpose we're trying to do, what the purpose the legislature is trying to accomplish, which is to provide good adult foster care.
Would you concede that there are logical difficulties on both sides, if you adopted your approach?
I would concede that. This is not what I would believe would be a paradigm of legislative drafting. Unless there's further questions, I see that my time has expired. I believe that the commissioner's failure to apply 245A07 is error, and as such, this matter should be reversed and remanded to the commissioner to apply 245A07. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen, and thank you to both attorneys for your argument.